This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Bernie Sanders just won West Virginia's primary on Tuesday, pulling in a whopping 51.4% of the vote compared to Hillary Clinton's 35.8%. The results mean he gets 18 of the state's delegates compared to Clinton's 11. But election analysts are still saying that Clinton's delegate lead is insurmountable. The West Virginia win comes on the heels of a Sanders win in Indiana. Now a growing chorus on social media dubbed #DropoutHillary is pointing to polls that have consistently shown Sanders doing far better against the presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump than Clinton in a general election. In fact, a new poll by Quinnipiac conducted in early May shows Clinton with only a 1% edge over Trump in Florida and Pennsylvania, while in Ohio, Trump beats her by 4% in a potential matchup. Sanders handily beats Trump in the same poll, leading to a singular conclusion that if the Democrats want the best chance of avoiding a Trump presidency, the party's superdelegates might be better off switching over to Sanders. My guest is Bill Fletcher. He's a racial justice, labor, and international activist, and author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions and Solidarity Divided. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Glad to be on the show.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, how important are these wins symbolically and also practically in West Virginia and Indiana? What does it say to you, not necessarily about Bernie versus Hillary, but about progressives all around the country and in those states?
I think it's very exciting, actually. And I think it's representative of essentially an uprising that's been taking place, that's been building for a while, in response to the economic policies that the Democratic Party has followed for the most part, and to the sense that something different needs to take place, needs to happen in this election. But I think at the same time, the polls that you cited should be viewed very cautiously. It's much too early to make any fundamental determination.
Well, just a few days ago, Bernie Sanders drew tens of thousands of people at a rally in Sacramento, California. California has its primary in early June. And in other parts of California, he's had the same, whereas Hillary Clinton has, you know, managed to fill maybe like a school basketball stadium. Do the sizes of the rallies matter? Are they an indication of anything beyond, you know, anything connected with the election, particularly given how disconnected our election system is from popular will?
They're representative of the fact that that Sanders is touching on to a sentiment that Clinton has been unable to a great extent. But I have to qualify that in a second. And so these rallies are, in fact, very important. But here's my cautionary note. We have not seen much in the way of red baiting yet. If Sanders gets the nomination, what I do not hear anyone talking about is the expectation we must have that there will be a phenomenal amount of red baiting, a phenomenal amount of tying red baiting to any kind of alleged softness on terrorism. And at that point, it's very hard to predict what will happen within the ranks of the Sanders supporters. See, Sanders has focused almost exclusively on economic injustice in the United States, and it's resonated. But this is a country that has been at the vanguard of anti-communism, of red baiting, terrorist baiting. And I think that one must expect, and we've seen glimmers of this and things that Trump has said, we must expect that if Sanders is the nominee, there will be that kind of attack. And progressives are going to need to be able to respond to that and not act dumbfounded, not act surprised, not act like deers in a headlight.
Now, given that this Sanders candidacy is happening in the wake of the Occupy Wall Street movement, of the Fight for 15 campaigns that have found so many successes, and also there's this new poll showing that the majority of young Americans are now skeptical of capitalism, isn't the timing for a Democratic socialist candidacy better now than ever before?
Yes and no. Yes, in that all of the polls that you've cited indicate that there is what I call a base for mass left radicalism. And I think that that's really exciting. That's great. The problem is it's not coherent yet. That's one problem. Second problem is that electoral politics are not simply about who wins the presidency. And what progressives have by and large missed is the development of a comprehensive national electoral strategy. Many of us, I have to say, unfortunately, only take an interest in electoral politics every 4 years. In between, we do very little. We often miss the midterm elections. We often pay little attention to state and local elections, whereas the other side, that is the right wing, pays very, very close attention to those races. And so I think that on the one hand, what Sanders has done is to advance a campaign. I would not call it a socialist campaign. And I don't mean that, I'm not being sarcastic or critical. I think that his campaign is very similar to the campaign of the Reverend Jesse Jackson in 1988. It's a progressive populist campaign. It is absolutely what we need. But it needs to be linked in with campaigns at other levels of the political structure. Because as Sanders himself says, even if he's elected, if nothing else changes, then it will be very difficult for him to affect any of the reforms that need to be, that are so badly needed at this point.
And how much of the fact that the left, you know, is essentially, there's a time that, as you're saying, is ripe for left organizing, and Sanders' candidacy and what it's inspiring is showing us that, how much of the fact that it hasn't happened is to be laid at the feet of the Democratic Party that seems intent on winning the White House at all costs and throwing their weight behind the Clintons at all costs? Meanwhile, Republicans are sweeping up local races. They've taken a hold of both houses of Congress. Some of that has to do with their gerrymandering. But they've really put a lot of effort into state-by-state organizing and even local organizing.
That's right. So first, we have to distinguish the left from the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
As my friend Carl Davidson says, the Democratic Party is actually a block of six different parties. And I think that framework is really important for your viewers to get, that we're not dealing with a traditional political party. We're dealing with something that's more like a united front that includes different tendencies, and you could really identify very distinct tendencies within the Democratic Party. So that's one point that I think is really to jump out with. The second is that I want to focus on specifically the left and your question. I would argue that most of the left, by left I define as people who are looking for a fundamental transformation of our system, that most of the left is A, unorganized, and B, does not have a national progressive electoral strategy. And as a result, we have been unable to take advantage of myriad opportunities in the electoral realm. So I would say that we first need to look at ourselves. The second thing is that the way that the Democratic Party has operated for quite a number of years has been to play it safe, to basically embrace neoliberal economics, you know, what Sanders, I think, calls hypercapitalism, to be somewhat fearful of the introduction of new constituencies. The combination of both of those factors means that the strategic advantage has fallen to the Republicans, who, as you have indicated, have had a long-term plan for the reversal of virtually everything that we earned and gained and won in the 20th century.
Now, let's also talk about the role that labor and unions are playing or could be playing in this. I mean, if we are, you know, if there's any sort of semblance of organized formation on the left, one might want to look at unions, organized labor, weak as it has been over the past several decades, have pledged allegiance to the Democratic Party for many years. What they've gotten out of it is unclear. You know, of course, certainly there's been marginal gains under Obama, but they've been marginal. Now, in this election, many of the major unions have thrown their weight behind Clinton. There's some exceptions, like the National Nurses United, who've very strongly supported Sanders. Is the organized labor movement in this country, such as it is, playing an effective role to advance left ideology and left policies in this country?
Well, certainly not left ideology, at least the way that I define left. I would say that in looking at organized labor, you have to recognize that it has lacked for a very long time an independent politics. I don't mean simply independent in a structural sense. I mean programmatically, that organized labor does not have what could be seriously defined as a workers' agenda around which people are uniting. And so what has happened over the last several decades, particularly, although one could make the argument that it started in the late 1940s, with the Cold War purges of the union movement. But what you see is the consistent tailing of the Democratic Party establishment by most of organized labor. Now, in this election cycle, what we've seen are some sharp differences and badly needed struggle about the future of working people in this country, about the future of the country. And that has resulted within the labor movement in differences about what candidate to support. In the beginning of this election cycle, I think most people would have assumed that it would have been a slam dunk for Hillary Clinton in terms of an endorsement, and that would have been it. It didn't quite work out that way. First at the base and then at the leadership level of several unions, you found increasing levels of support for Sanders. I think that this is great. That's the kind of debate that we need. And that's what will propel the movement forward.
Let's talk about Trump. I know that you think it's too early to look at these general election matchups and the polls that show Clinton just sort of barely beating Trump. And certainly Clinton seems to be banking on the strategy that as the nominee of the party, people will be so, the general electorate will be so afraid of Trump that they will vote for her as the lesser evil. Even if she isn't coming out and casting herself as the lesser evil, she must know and her campaign advisors must know that that's the strategy they are banking on. Now, that is a pretty effective argument, just given where Trump is at and who he is and what he represents. But it seems to me to be a great tragedy that any political party is relying on this strategy as a winning strategy. And it also seems to me to be a very sad statement on the state of American democracy. What are your thoughts on that?
There's this saying that was attributed to Mahatma Gandhi, where he was asked, what did he think of Western civilization? And he mulled it over and said that he thought it would be a good idea.
Right.
And I think the same about democracy in the United States. It would be a good idea. In many ways, this is a very undemocratic country. And it is a country steeped in a tradition of settler colonialism and white supremacy. And so what we see in the Trump candidacy, and we also saw in the Cruz candidacy, is what I call a revanchist politics. That is a politics steeped in revenge. And the revenge is both domestic and international. It is a revenge that is saying, that's based on the idea that the United States is no longer playing the role in the world that many people thought it should. It's also steeped in domestic revenge, that we're having demographic changes in this country, where we're having a situation where the United States no longer looks like the Donna Reed show from the 1950s. And there are many white people that really are upset about that. So when Trump talks about we're going to take back America, he doesn't mean take it back from the Democratic Party. He means, in effect, take it back from the other. And who is the other? Well, it depends. The other can be Latino immigrants, African Americans for sure, gays, lesbians,
Muslims,
women, right? These groups that have been traditionally disenfranchised by U.S. democracy. And this is what he is arguing. And he has all sorts of codes for that. Now, I start there because it's really important when people talk a lot about, well, there's this angry electorate out there and they're turning to Trump. Well, yeah, but they could be turning to Sanders. In other words, if you're really that angry about the economy, why go to Trump? This rich white guy who has bankrupted several companies, who started with a golden spoon in his mouth. Why go there? Why not go to Sanders? And the answer lies in race. It lies in race.
Even though Bernie Sanders is also an older white guy, but of course he doesn't use this sort of dog whistle politics that Trump does.
It's not just that he's an older white guy. Bernie Sanders does not come out of the capitalist class.
Yeah. His net worth is pretty small, actually, even for a senator, especially right. For a senator.
Precisely. I mean, we're dealing with the intersection of race and class here, and the electorate that is looking to Trump is looking to the great leader, quote unquote, to restore white people, and particularly white men, to the position in society that they believe, that many of them believe, they are entitled to. That this is, in fact, a white republic, and the rest of us are guests, wanted and unwanted. So the Trump phenomena is incredibly dangerous, and you're absolutely right that an argument against Trump that's simply based on vote for me, I'm not nuts, is not going to be a winning or visionary approach. That we need, and I think that Clinton is actually being pushed as a result of the Sanders insurgency, to say things that she had probably never expected to say. We need a visionary candidacy. And that's why I think that this is going to be right up to the convention. I think there's going to be serious struggle at the convention around platform, as well as the vice presidency. And there might even be a real battle around the presidential nomination, depending on how close Sanders and Clinton end up getting.
Right. And on the positions that you were mentioning, Clinton just apparently endorsed the position that she would be in favor of letting people as young as 50 buy into or basically join Medicare, the Medicare program, which, you know, Sanders wants Medicare for all. Looks like now Clinton's okay with Medicare for everybody 50 and over, which is as close as she, I think, has ever come to single-payer health care.
I think that that's right. And see, this is why struggle pays. Right. This is why movements are so important. But here's the catch. Without organization, you can't sustain any of this. See, that's what the right wing understands much better than we do, unfortunately, at least in this time in history. They build organizations and institutions to sustain their efforts, recognizing that efforts are going to go up and down over time. That if you don't have organization to sustain them, you will ultimately lose. And we have been losing immensely over the years because of our poor level of organization.
Well, let's see how that ends up playing out between now and November. Bill, always a pleasure to have you on. Give out a website and your Twitter handle.
I do. So you can reach me at BillFletcherJr.com. And my Twitter is at Bill Fletcher. And I'm on Facebook as well.
And we'll post links to that from our website later today. Thank you so much, Bill.
My pleasure.
Bill Fletcher is a racial justice, labor, and international activist, author of a number of books, including They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions and Solidarity Divided. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.